Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Regional Vice Chair Roger Thomas and me, Tony Gosling. He is, of course, from the PCS. And we asked one of Britain's biggest unions about the economic crisis and find out how they plan to deal with hundreds of thousands of redundancy. And tomorrow is Bristol Gay Pride Day, the culmination of a week-long programme of events with a parade from Queen's Square to Castle Park and an after-party at the Trinity Centre. We hear from Gay Pride's Louise Trimby. We also hear from Pastor of the Spirit of Life Church in St Paul's, Dia Moodley, who questions the role of Britain's gay community. And we have the final excerpt from Keith Allen's film Unlawful Killing about the death of Princess Diana. The film's being shown all around the world except here in Britain, where it's banned. And to round up, just before 7, Channel 4 News Political Personality of the Year in 2007 died last month, former merchant seaman and Parliament Square peace protester Brian Hoare. It's an interview I did with him at a Stop the War demonstration back in 2008. Before all that, you've heard him in the first hour, but I'm going to put some direct questions now to Roger Thomas, who's Regional Vice Chair at the PCS, Public and Commercial Services Union. Okay, Roger, here we go. First of all, is your union affiliated to the Labour Party? Do you pay certain amounts of money to them?
No, we don't pay any money to the Labour Party. We are completely unaffiliated to any political organisation.
And what about the biggest dispute that you're involved in at the moment? This is ongoing, and it's mostly about pensions. But isn't it, aren't you just simply going to have to face up to the fact that we've only got the same amount of money to be dealing with, and actually people are living longer, so you're just going to simply have to accept a restructuring of the contracts that your members are doing with their pensions?
Right, well, I mean, there are a number of questions there and a number of issues that I need to deal with. Firstly, I don't think it's just about pensions, it's about jobs and services as well. So that's why when we took our strike action, that was precisely the question that we asked our members to take strike action over.
So what exactly was the question you asked them?
Well, the question was around strike action over jobs, services and the defence of our pensions. And if I could say on the question of pensions, the average civil servant actually earns around £21,000 a year and would probably leave the civil service with a pension of around £4,200 a year. It's hardly a king's ransom. There is one public sector pension which surprisingly is not being discussed, and that is that of MPs who are at the moment looking at the question of ring fence in that particular pension, which has the highest accrual rate, 1 to 40th, of any pension scheme anywhere in the country. And the other issue I'd raise is the subsidy which is given by the government to the private tax industry, which is to do with the pension contributions of the top income earners in British society. And I think, when the government talk about a level playing field and everybody tightening their belts, well, we'd like to see some tightening elsewhere before we really see it as a serious contribution to any debate on the future of public services.
But there's only a tiny number of MPs compared to your hundreds of thousands of PCS members. And aren't you, in a way, in denial here? Because Britain is becoming a less wealthy country. Countries like China are taking over as the industrial base of the world. And ultimately, we are just simply not going to be able to live in the way in which we have the comfort to which we have been accustomed, should we say. So really you're just failing to change with the times. Are changing, but PCS is not.
Well, Britain is still the sixth wealthiest country in the world. It's not a poor country. It's not in the situation of a third world country. It has enormous wealth, And we have a situation where £120 billion is lost every year through tax evasion and avoidance, or simply because HMRC, Their Majesty's Revenue and Customs, have not got the staff to collect it.
Isn't this in a situation
where 30,000 jobs have gone in HMRC.
But aren't you not doing your job? Are your members not doing their job? If they're allowing people who are high tax earners to get away with actually not paying as much tax as they should be. Well, you know, we've seen these campaigns, UK Uncut, for example, saying that actually there's loads of tax which should be being collected. Surely your members bear a responsibility for that as well.
Well, I think the government bears a responsibility for the lack of collecting of this level of tax because, as I just said, 30,000 jobs have been cut this in the recent period. And, you know, if a government was serious about plugging that gap, which would solve the situation of the deficit, then they would be employing more tax inspectors to go after the richest, the big corporations who are paying next to nothing in corporation tax, and the most wealthy and powerful in our society who are avoiding paying tax. Dare I say it? George Osborne does actually hold his money overseas in trust and, doesn't pay tax. So we have other people who are in a similar situation who are, who choose to live overseas and not pay tax, but, you know, are very wealthy individuals. They should be paying their share of tax to pay for services so that everybody can have the kind of services which they deserve.
I think maybe also you could look at the HSBC, for example. The trouble being, and this is the bind the government's in, and I think it's surely it's unfair for you to be blaming them, because they look at a big organisation like HSBC, Hong Kong Shanghai Bank Corporation, and that what they're doing is they're saying, well, look, if you start taxing us more, we're simply going to move to Hong Kong, mate. And so the government is scratching its head, thinking, well, actually, you're blaming the government for not getting money off of them, but if they were to actually come down much tougher on HSBC, all HSBC would do is stick two fingers up at George Osborne and David Cameron and move to Hong Kong.
Well, with a lot of these banks, the public has a substantial stake in them, and as a result of when the banking system went into collapse, we bailed out those institutions, and I think the return for that bailing out through the use of public money, taxpayers' money, should be that we end the bonus culture in those particular banks, and that those banks pay their fair share into the running of a society in Britain, and indeed wherever else they are organising. I think it's abhorrent that any organisation should seek to avoid tax, particularly when we're talking about millions, and then we have the government saying that we have to carry through cuts as a consequence in public services which are delivered to those that are most needy in our society.
But you can't blame David Cameron and George Osborne for that. This is something that happened, the bailout, which happened under Gordon Brown.
Well, I think that what has taken place since that bailout took place is that there has been an attempt to change the public parameters of the debate from a situation where it was the fault of the banking system and the lack of control on the banking system, the lack of accountability within the banking system, and somehow then to turn that back to a situation of public sector deficit as if it was the public services which were responsible for the crisis, which was obviously created in the first place by the collapse in the banking system. These are services which are delivered at a local level by councils, the National Health Service, by our members in various government departments, that make a substantial difference to the quality of life that ordinary people have in this country. If we see those services taken away and those public utilities destroyed, then what we will have is a situation where you will get a service, you will get health care if you can pay for it, but if you can't, then you will either get nothing or a very poor residue of a service, and I think that's not the kind of society that any of us want to live in.
But surely George Osborne and David Cameron are being quite sensible. They're saying, well, look, we just can't afford to run this massive civil service anymore with these hundreds and hundreds of thousands of employees in order for the country to actually be able to have a successful, you know, be able to actually raise taxes in the future. Mm. We're going to have to cut it down. And I come back to this point again. Surely the PCS and the members that you represent are actually in denial about this. They're trying to carry on where actually the whole tide is turning, and actually they're trying to carry on in the same direction as they have been before.
No, I think the tide is turning. I think at the start of this particular debate, the mantra was from every area of the media, right across and across the political spectrum, including the Labour Party, unfortunately, the Lib Dems, Conservatives, that cuts are absolutely essential in order to go forward. I think the PCS has acted responsibly in terms of offering up an alternative, that is to invest in proper public services, which will provide jobs, which mean that people in jobs pay tax and national insurance rather than seeking to claim those benefits when they're forced out of work. So I think it shows that the policies that the government are pushing forward are actually making things worse rather than actually starting to get us out of the economic difficulties that we find ourselves in. And I think, you know, it is ridiculous that we have a huge subsidy of $38 billion into the private sector pension industry. And I think, you know, we have to have, if we're going to have a discussion on pensions, let's have a serious discussion which includes private sector provision. You know, the government have tried to throw in this idea, well, a lot of workers in the private sector haven't got a pension, so therefore the people in the public sector shouldn't have a pension. Well, I'd say everybody should have a decent pension, which should be available to them at a decent retirement age, so they can enjoy a long and fruitful life after they've concluded their working days.
Okay, now can you just give us an idea of how your union operates with other unions? I mean, do you actually interact with, because you mean with for example, with the big march that was in London back a couple of months ago, it wasn't just your union, was it? It was some of the other major unions too were there. So where is this public sector pension thing? Which unions are actually acting together on this?
Well, we're trying to work with as many unions as we possibly can, and obviously we're working through the TUC, which is the umbrella organisation for all of the trade unions, to put forward a strategy to defend public sector pensions. And we've recently started a campaign with unions like the NUT, the Teachers Union and ATL and UCU on the question of, you know, everybody has the right to have a decent pension in their old age.
And so who are ATL and UCU?
Well, they're the University College Union and the Association of Teachers and Lecturers. There are other unions that were involved in the strike action that we took on June the 30th, and we've been working very closely in Bristol and on a regional and national basis in order to coordinate our efforts and to organise rallies and demonstrations on that particular day, the campaign effectively. But also what we're trying to do is to move it beyond that to the other unions. A year or so ago we signed an accord, PCS, with Unison to do joint activity where we can, and at our conference this year we signed an accord with the Unite trade union. And obviously, you know, we're seeking to build as many bridges as we possibly can with all the unions in the TUC to fight for properly funded pensions for every single member of the British population.
So do you actually think that maybe you've done the wrong thing by not affiliating to the Labour Party? Because surely right now, Ed Miliband could be your spokesperson in the House of Commons, actually pushing these ideas on a national level. And yet, because you haven't affiliated to the Labour Party, he's not doing that. Because I noticed at the march about pensions and the march about the cuts recently, Ed Miliband was up there saying, well, actually, I think there needs to be cuts. And I mean, surely, if you haven't got him on board, you're not going to get anywhere in the political arena.
Well, I think it's very unfortunate that the Labour Party have taken this particular line, and I think it does sit very badly for the likes of Ed Miliband and for, you know, the Labour Party nationally and standing any chance of winning any election and putting forward an alternative. I think, you know, it has also helped to hold up this idea that cuts are inevitable. And we've had to find other means. We've had to go out and talk with members of the public. We've been active in terms of setting up anti-cuts alliances in cities and towns across the country, including in Bristol, where PCS, along with the NUT, were in quite to the fore in terms of pushing the foundation of that particular organisation, so that we can go out and campaign amongst people about what the issues are involved in the cuts that are taking place.
Okay, so can you tell us where this campaign that PCS is going? We've got, I don't know, strikes, anything like this? Well, maybe not a strike, but a rally or whatever. And what are the next steps that you're taking?
Well, obviously we had the very successful TUC demonstration on March the 26th, and then we built on that in terms of the June the 30th strike day. And what we're campaigning for is we're going out to the public. We've got an overtime ban on at the moment. Not that there's much overtime in the civil service, but, you know, we've got those campaigning initiatives. But what we're trying to do is to reach out to all the other organisations in the public sector to come on board for the maximum possible unity to take, you know, possibly further action in the autumn in order to defend pensions. I mean, we are not going to sit back quietly and just accept the government cutting our jobs, cutting our terms and conditions, destroying the public sector and destroying our pensions. It is a right of every worker to enjoy a decent life once they retire after years of work
But the trouble is, of course, we sort of wrap this up, but the problem here is that whenever you take strike action, almost any industrial action that you take, the public suffers.
Well, I think amazingly, people are seeing that, seeing the reasons for us taking action. I think, a lot of people have understood why we've needed to take action. You know, I'd like us to be able to provide the kind of services where people, when they're in difficulty, can easily access those services. Increasingly, it's becoming more and more difficult to access services, to get advice, and to get help. Much of it is now dependent on you having a telephone rather than being able to walk into a local office and take advice over the counter and then obviously make the appropriate claims for those pensions or those benefits that you require in times of difficulty or indeed for advice over tax issues. So, you know, I think it's become more and more difficult to access those services, and I think, you know, that's why we have to resist these cuts. That's why we have to have decent, properly funded services in the public sector so that people can enjoy decent lives. And I think the public services are what protect us from living in quite a barbaric society. They are what give us that element of civilization in our lives. And I think, you know, they're important and very precious. I think obviously the most important of those is the National Health Service. And I think, you know, there is quite a rebranding taking place in terms of the proposals that the government is pushing through. But if those proposals are successfully pushed through, then it will result in virtually the end of the National Health Service. All it will be a brand name on a board, while a whole host of private sector organisations deliver a very diminished and very poor service.
Well, on that rather scary note, thanks very much, Roger Thomas, Regional Vice Chair of PCS Public and Commercial Services Union, for joining us here on Drive Time. And it's Gay Pride after some music.
Right. Thank you.
of you, why don't you do right like some other men do? Get out of here and get me some money too. You're sitting down wondering what it's all about. You ain't got no money, they will put you out. Why don't you do right like some other men do? Get out of here and get me some money too. If you had prepared 20 years ago, you wouldn't be a wandering out from door to door. Why don't you do right like some other men do? Get out of here and get me some money too. Drink a gin, why don't you do right like some other men do? Get out of here and get me some money too. Why don't you do right like some other men do? Like some other men do.
That's Peggy Lee with Benny Goodman and his orchestra, and Why Don't You Do Right? Now, it was 1967 that homosexuality was first decriminalised here in the UK, in Scotland 1981 and Northern Ireland 1982, before people could be openly gay. The first US state decriminalised it in 1961 and the last one finally in 2003. While many people see this as a great liberation from thousands of years of prejudice and oppression, some see gay culture as undermining some parts of society. Whatever your view, there's no denying the excitement, joy and colour of Bristol's Gay Pride events and gay community, which culminates tomorrow with the march from Queen's Square, appropriately, to Castle Park and to the concerts there. So I'm joined by Mary Milton, who's from the Shout Out Show here on BCFM. Hi, Mary, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hiya, Tony. Nice to talk to you.
Now, first of all, could you tell us what's been going on during the week before we talk about tomorrow?
Yeah, there's been all sorts of things going on in the week. We started off last weekend where the Shout Out Show actually took over BCFM for a whole day. And we had a whole day of broadcasting on the station of interest to LGBT people and their friends. And then the Pride team have been busy all week organising events. There was a brilliant theatre show at the Tobacco Factory Monday and Tuesday. And some comedy last night, which I was at as well, which was also really good.
But is the march tomorrow, is that just for gay people?
No, how they're actually promoting it is it's for anybody who believes in equality and thinks equality is important. Obviously, that will be LGBT people, but their friends, families, anyone who values that is welcome along.
Now, can you just explain what this LGBT people is? What does it stand for? Because this is one of those acronyms people use, isn't it?
Actually, it's terrible. It's a terrible acronym. But what it stands for is lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender. We haven't come up with a better name to describe all of us en masse that everyone's happy with.
I'm sure you will sometime.
I hope so.
Also, what about the concerts? And because there's some music tomorrow and there's a big after-party concert at the Trinity Centre, I know. To what extent is this a march to kind of just join along with, and to what extent is it actually free?
The free part of it, the march is absolutely free. That's the one you were talking about that leaves Queen's Square at 12. And that march is to Castle Park. Apparently that will take about an hour for everyone to get there. And at that point, it's a ticketed event into the park. Which I believe is £10 on the door, but I'm not actually part of the Pride Committee, so I'm not too certain of that. And then the parties in the evening are all run in clubs and at Trinity, and they all attract a fee as well.
Now, I'd appreciate it if you could stay on the line while we hear what some would see as something as a party-pooping point of view from the Evangelical Spirit of Life Church. Dia Moodley, you're the pastor there. Welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you.
Now, will you be going along to this Gay Pride March tomorrow?
I certainly not.
Well, why is that?
Well, I don't believe it's... well, if anybody has any clue of Christianity, and that's what I'm a part of, we believe it's... something unnatural. A lot of the people in the Christian faith are fighting against it. We believe that it's not right, and that we should have an opportunity also to express that it's not right, and we should also be heard on the matter.
But the trouble is, of course, I mean, you're saying that the Christian faith says it's not right. Actually, the Church of England is slowly actually embracing the gay community. So why aren't you?
That's because we're being asked to conform to something. I mean, a lot of the people in the Church of England, which I can't really comment on because I'm not from the Church of England, but hearing friends talk and hearing people speak from the Church of England, I think that a lot of people are being forced to conform to this idea that we have to be accepting of just everything. And I think that the Christian faith has its values, has its moral code, has its commandments, its rules of living, and we have to abide by that. And we shouldn't be forced to conform to what others want us to conform to.
But is there actually any kind of completely empirical reason, rather than what the Bible says or whatever? Why do you actually think that there's something wrong with being gay? Because particularly many gay people will say, actually, I'm born like this, so how can I change?
Well, if you're born in a garage, it doesn't make you a motor car. If you're born in McDonald's, it doesn't make you a Happy Meal. If you're born in poverty, it doesn't mean you got to stay poor the rest of your life. I think that that's a poor excuse for someone to say, this is how I was born and I'm going to live my life the rest of this way. People change through life. People change through various experiences. They change through knowledge. They change through a spiritual experience. And we've had many people that have testified to that. So people change. And I think we have to give people an opportunity to change. Yes, I know that the argument is that this is the way we were born and we can't change that. But also on the other end, there are people who have changed. And we have documents about that. People have witnessed to that. That people are changing and have changed.
Now, Mary Milton, do feel free to chip in at any point you want to, but I would say to you, Dia Moodley, from the Evangelical Spirit of Life Church, many people will see you as actually putting up barriers to gay people wanting to otherwise would like to join your church.
Well, you can, by all means. I mean, nobody's excluded from the church. Everyone's welcome. The church doors are open, and anybody who closes the church doors to anybody is not actually having church. Church is open to anybody of any faith or of any part of the society we're in. Everyone's welcome.
But many gay people may see, your attitude is actually quite a bullying attitude. You're not accepting them for who they are.
Well, Jesus accepted people and said, listen, I love the person that you are. The Bible says that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, Jesus Christ, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have eternal life. That means he loves the people of the world, but he doesn't love the things we do sometimes. And that's the problem. Everybody's welcome, but we may not necessarily love what you're doing, but we'll love you. We'll welcome you, but we may not welcome what you're doing.
Now, Mary, in your experience, have you found that all Christians have this attitude?
Not at all, actually. And we have had a few Christians on our show, actually, talking about their faith, and they don't seem to have any problems reconciling their sexuality with their faith. And as the pastor so correctly said, that, I'm not a religious person myself, but my understanding of it is that that Jesus preached tolerance and love, and the gay people that we have on our show who are Christian say things like that and say that they feel completely accepted by Christianity in their sexuality.
So, dear, why aren't you preaching tolerance and love? Surely that's what Jesus wants you to do.
Fantastic. We are preaching that. Open arms, tolerance and love. If we're not preaching love, we're not preaching the gospel. Jesus loved everybody. He loved the lady who was a prostitute, but he didn't agree with the fact that she was prostituting her body. So there are things. A thief can walk into our church. A murderer can walk into our church. A pedophile can walk into our church. Anybody can walk into any church. And God loves each and every one of those people, but he may not love what they're doing. And if they continue down that path, it doesn't mean that we've just got to accept it. No, we have to be able to say, listen, if you're gonna come and into the church, we welcome you, we love you, but we don't actually love what you're doing. And why don't you love what we're doing? Because God says that these things are not right. We have to be able to put these things right. And from Leviticus to Revelation, which is the Bible from one end to the other end, speaks of this thing called an abomination, which is an unnatural act that God speaks about in his word. And we have to abide by that. And all we're looking to do is to say, listen, respect us for what we believe as well.
I don't want to get into a big religious debate here, as I'm not a religious expert, but as I understand it, the word homosexual wasn't actually coined at the time that the Bible was written, so that any translation in the modern day Bible that does use the word homosexual, that's actually not a correct translation of what it actually said.
Now, Mary, I mean, I've heard this sort of thing as well, particularly from Anglican people. They're saying, well, actually, a lot of Anglican people don't believe that that Jesus actually did condemn in any way homosexuality, that this is something really left over from the Old Testament.
Yeah, most of the quotes that are given are from the Old Testament.
That Jesus kind of came along to sweep this away, and you're kind of living in the Old Testament.
No, definitely not. We can't say, I mean, like you rightly said, you got to have somebody who can talk about this, who knows what they're talking about from the Old Testament and the New. And we as Christians believe that the New Testament is not the be-all and the end-all of our Christianity. The Old Testament is important. There's a reason why the Old Testament is there. And the Old Testament law does not just talk about man lying with another man or a woman lying with another woman. It talks about every aspect of life, from marriage to how to raise your children, to how to run your finances, to how to build a home, to how to get a job, and how to treat people.
And so, how to not wear a shirt made out of two different types of fiber.
Of course, well,
polyester.
Well, it talks about various things. You are right in what you're saying. It talks about various things. It talks about women.
I think I could actually be doing that right now. And would I be condemned?
I think that there are many good things that we can take from the Bible, but there are also things that have possibly become outdated now, which we can look at in a different way. And I think there's a lot of examples of that. And homosexuality obviously isn't the only one.
Okay, I'm going to give a final word to you, dear. I want to hear nothing to do with the Bible, but I want to hear why you think that there is a negative side to gay rights. Because, I mean, we've seen over the last 20 years or so a massive progression, and many would see that as actually a kind of moving forward of civilization and a liberation of a lot of people. So if someone is homosexual, why should that actually affect their life in any way? Why is it wrong in your view?
Well, you've asked me two questions there. So,
okay, you are. Answer them both then.
Well, if we don't take the Christian point of view, just from an ordinary viewpoint, I will say that I would not want to be bullied into accepting something. That if I don't accept it, that I'm going to be not accepted in schools, or I'm not going to be accepted at university, I'm not going to be accepted in the job environment because I have a particular view about homosexuality. I would like to feel that my view is also not only appreciated but respected, and I think that's important. From a Christian point of view, we have to, as Christians, speaking as a Christian, I've got to abide by, and I love to abide by, the Word of God. And I've got to believe what the Word of God says. It's not outdated. It's still relevant for me today. It's alive. It's working for many, many people around the world, in the city and around the world. It's working. We have to abide by what the Word of God says for us, and that's what we choose to do.
Okay, George, just finally plug your church. Tell us where you are and when you meet.
Well, we're at the Spirit of Life Church. We're at the bottom of the M32 as you go into the city centre, opposite Cabot Circus. Our main services is on Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. We finish by 12:30, and we have a phenomenal time.
Okay, dear Moodley, thanks very much. And I actually told a bit of a fib, Mary, because I'm going to give you the last word. Can you just tell us again, remind us what are the main events tomorrow?
Okay, the main events tomorrow are gathering in Queen Square at 12 o'clock to leave for Castle Park, where the festivities, for want of a better word, start at 1 o'clock.
That's lovely. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you also very much, dear, for coming in and talking to us today.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Now, a false flag terror attack is when the group, country or political faction blamed for a bomb or other outrage are actually the enemy of the people who actually carried it out. It's rather like the grisly phenomenon of self-harming, and we did deal with this topic last week, and it's the final part this week. The aim is simple as this: to make an aggressor look like the victim and the victim to look like the aggressor. One telltale sign of this is when there's a very quick revelation as to who's behind an attack, like on 9/11 and 7/7, when Bush and Blair respectively announced on the same day of the attacks the Islamic faction was going to be behind it all. But NATO has a disturbing track record of this type of cowardly act. It's called Operation Gladio, and it was supposed to be the most secret operation NATO have ever carried out. But some of those tasked to carry out these attacks were so disgusted with what they'd been ordered to do that they blew the whistle. Well, I spoke to Swiss historian Danny Alleganzer and asked him recently about the topic of his book, NATO's Secret Armies, and how we can figure out if a bomb has been planted by one side or the other. Is it actually possible? If there was a terrorist attack somewhere in Europe, how do we know whether it's an Al-Qaeda attack, possibly China, in the future we may be in confrontation with China, or if it's NATO that's blown up a bomb?
In fact, we don't know. That's the scary thing. If we see a terrorist attack, we have the media telling us the next day who it was. I mean, you know, that was the same thing in London, in Madrid. We had this on 9/11, we had this in Mumbai, we have this all over the place, in Bali, etc. So you usually have the terrorist attack, which shocks the entire population, because the shock effect is, oh, it could have been me dying on that airplane or airport or train station, etc. That is the strategy of tension. People are shocked. And then the next day, when everybody's still in shock, you insert the message who it was. And scientists who then later try to find out whether that message was true or not face a lot of difficulties, because we research, in some cases, it's private terrorism. So it can be the Red Brigades. They, in fact, carried out terrorist attacks. So, you know, in some cases it's true, or it can be Al-Qaeda. In some cases they carry out terrorist attacks. But in other cases, it's state-sponsored terrorism, so that you actually have the taxes going to the government, who gives it to the Secret Services, who then hand it over to sinister criminals who carry out some terrorist attacks. And that makes it really complicated for historians to differentiate in each case, is it state-sponsored terrorism or is it private terrorism of a criminal group?
You know, it almost sounds to me, Daniel, as if there's a bit of a wrestling going on here between the politicians in Western Europe and NATO to command the agenda as to where the real threats are from. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, that is going on because we are being maneuvered through stories. We always hear stories of a threat. At the time of the Cold War, and here the data is really clear, we in the West were told that all actions that were evil were actually directed by Moscow. So it's clear that every terrorist attack was somehow directed by Moscow or communists in Western Europe. And now we find out that we've had NATO, the CIA and MI6 and other groups who were actually our structure to protect us, who were linked to terrorist attacks. Or we have data in Northern Ireland where you also have false flags terrorism. Or we have, for instance, that's an interesting story. We have the French who were angry with Greenpeace protesting in New Zealand against the French were carrying out nuclear testing in the Pacific. And then Greenpeace went there with their boat and got in the way, so they couldn't do their nuclear testing in the Pacific. So they went there and blew up the Greenpeace ship. And then the French Secret Service, that was state terrorism in the 1980s, and then the French Secret Service said, no, we have nothing to do with it. And it took, like, you know, I don't know, 5 or 10 years to get the full story. So I'm telling you, to research terrorism is incredibly difficult.
Now, one of the worrying things that you've said there is that the CIA and MI6 seem to be quite key people in this, along with NATO intelligence in Brussels. Is it right, then, that the British seem to be doing quite a lot of the training of these stay behind terrorists in the Gladio case, but also they are themselves state terrorists when they're blowing up ordinary people?
I mean, that is a highly delicate question that you ask. But I mean, most people in UK, and you know, I started in the UK, and most people would say, no, it's impossible. How could my tax money be used to blow up anybody? I mean, the MI6, if ever it does anything like that, would be attacked by the press, and then Parliament would watch over them, and some judge would step in and stop the whole thing. And what I can tell you is that Parliament has no clue about state-sponsored terrorism. I mean, if you research the archives, you find nothing on it. But the media, they don't actually work on the subject that often, apart from a small radio station like yours, maybe. And in academia, we have very hard time to find out specific cases where CIA or MI6 sponsored terrorist attacks. But one example, in 1953 in Iran, we had the overthrow of the Mossadegh government. And it was very important to get the people there angry. So we have CIA operatives who carry out terrorist attacks, you know, through some bombs into some mosques, and then steered up hatred, steered up fear. And that is the strategy of tension, which in the end helped to topple a government and control the oil in the region. So these things are not just fantasy, but they are very difficult to research. And it is important to stay with a specific case in a specific country and a specific year. So that's what I tried to do with my book on the NATO secret arms. I did it on 400 pages, and everybody who's interested can dig into the material.
That was Danny Eleganser, author of a book called NATO's Secret Armies, and he's a lecturer at Basel University in Switzerland and did his PhD here at the London School of Economics in Britain.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now, it's the final part this week of Keith Allen's banned film, Unlawful Killing, which examines the evidence that Princess Diana didn't die in a common or garden car accident, but was assassinated. And this week, he looks at the most likely motive, which is Diana's courageous attack on Britain and France's powerful arms industry. And this film is banned in Britain, but it's being watched all over the world.
There was a powerful reason why the secret services of Britain, France, and America might have wanted Diana dead. It was Diana's involvement in the campaign to ban landlines. In the 1990s, some 85 million mines lay in wait in 62 countries. 2,000 people were being maimed or killed by them every month. A worldwide movement to ban anti-personnel landmines gathered speed during 1996. To everyone's surprise, even the world's most powerful politician was sympathetic to the ban.
To end this carnage, the United States will seek a worldwide agreement as soon as possible to end the use of all anti-personnel landmines.
Diana, Princess of Wales, took up the cause with a vengeance. In January 1997, she visited Angola, resulting in the greatest photo opportunity that the landmine campaign had ever had.
One down.
Firing.
Her involvement caused huge anger amongst governments. In Britain, Government Defence Minister Earl Howe denounced her.
Two newspapers this morning quoting unnamed ministers described as a loose cannon.
This is an important, sophisticated argument, and it doesn't help simply to point at the amputees and say how terrible it is.
I very much regret that because of her position she gets so much publicity for it.
Simone Simmons was with Diana in February 1997. When a government defence minister made a threatening phone call warning the princess to end her involvement with the campaign, otherwise accidents could happen.
We were sitting down having tea one day, and the phone went in her little lounge, and she picked it up and then called me over, and there was a voice that was in the middle of a conversation saying, "Don't meddle in things you know nothing about. Accidents can happen." She went a bit pale. She took it as a threat, and she said that was Nicholas Soames.
Well, fascinating. Nicholas Soames, grandson of Winston Churchill, a bastion of the establishment, here accused, hearsay perhaps, of making a phone call, threatening phone call to Diana. Was she just a headache, or was she a danger at some point to national security, do you think, Noel?
I think she was. Bill Clinton promised her in August that year that he would vote in favour of a ban on landmines at the Oslo conference, which was due to take place on the 19th of September. There was enormous pressure from the military in America to get him to stop that, to change his mind. Enormous lobbying at the White House. But because he when Dan had been staying with them, and had publicly said it in that August. We know he was not a very strong moral person, from various other stories. And it was thought by the military that with Diana alive, he would not change his mind. He would definitely vote in favour of a ban, which they did not want. Of course, after her death, 19 days later, Bill Clinton went to Oslo and voted against a ban on landmines. The only voice, in fact, in the West that voted that way, which he would never have had the moral courage to do had she been alive.
That was final voice there was Noel Botham, author of The Murder of Princess Diana. And he was being interviewed there by Lauren Booth, the cousin, or was it? No, the sister of Sherry Blair, who's converted to Islam. And they were both appearing there on a review programme on the Iranian channel Press TV.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Now, 3 weeks ago, the press was buzzing with the leaked words of David Cameron's boss. I say David Cameron's boss, you thought he didn't have a boss, but he does. Whitney constituency chairman Christopher Shale, and it's Christopher Shale's job to oversee the process of selecting the parliamentary candidate, in this case, David Cameron. Chris Shale said that the Tory party needed to go to thoroughly re-examine itself. The Conservative Party of 2011 was, and I quote, voracious, crass, and always on the take. 3 days later, his dead body was found in a public port-a-loo at the Glastonbury Festival. A swift post-mortem was carried out, but pathologists said the cause of death appeared to be a natural heart attack, but ultimately the pathologist's report was inconclusive. Around the world, there are a few people who specialise in these possible assassinations, and one is a barrister and member of the Royal United Services Institute, Michael Shrimpton. Here's the final part of last week's interview. I spoke to him 2 weeks ago from what he called a safe house in New Zealand. And this, in the final part of the interview, Michael explains that inducing a heart attack is actually one of the favourite methods of hired killers, and used to assassinate sometimes their political opponents.
Yes, there are a number of ways. Indeed, you don't necessarily need to introduce a toxin into the body. One popular method of killing someone and then having it disguised as a heart attack is simply an embolism, introducing air. And there are a number of drugs with very, very short life in the bloodstream where you need a very, very good pathologist to pick them up. So there are a number of ways in which you can murder someone and simulate it as a heart attack. But I emphasize, it's not a conspiracy theory. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. At the end of the day, it's a question of fact. Was he murdered or was he not? If he was murdered, who murdered him and what was the motive? At this stage, based on the evidence available and the inquiries I've been able to make, it's a probable assassination. CIA, I understand, are saying the same thing privately, and I understand the Russian SVR service has come to the same conclusion.
That was Barrister Michael Shrimpton talking about the suspicious death 3 weeks ago at Glastonbury of David Cameron's constituency party chairman, Christopher Shale.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Now, Channel 4 News, political personality of 2007 died last month. The former merchant seaman and Parliament Square peace protester, Brian Hoare. And here's an unedited interview with him that I took, I did at a Stop the War demonstration back in 2008.
I'm underwhelmed. Underwhelmed. 2 million people? Do you recall that?
I do.
30,000? Wow. Because things are so much better today, aren't they? Things have resolved. Things are so much happier for the people in Afghanistan and Iraq. Has anybody noticed what's going on? Carnage, bloodshed, we're wiping them all out. We, our country, is wiping all these people out, just like those people wiped out those people called Americans. Do you remember that one all those years back? The people who used to have the feathers in their hair and the wigwams, the Americans. Murdered, slaughtered, carnage, genocide by these invaders from our country amongst other countries, yeah?
So what's it like having everybody here today? Do you feel like a sense of solidarity?
You're not listening, are you? Everybody is not here. Most people are not here, are they? We said 30,000? 2 million? Now how many people in this country know what's going on is so awful, so wrong? They don't know how awful, because quite frankly the media doesn't show us very much, does it? The media doesn't show us the blood in the body on the... Oh, it shows us a bit of blood on the streets, but it doesn't show us the blown-up babies, does it? It doesn't show us the bodies. It doesn't show us the sheer and utter carnage. They're all dying over there. But hey, folks, our conscience are okay, aren't they? Because we come out on a march, and we can feel, oh, I've done my bit. 30,000, 2 million? How many millions are dead? Do you know what? When 2 million took to the streets, that was good, wasn't it? Bloody good. From all sections of the community, all our people, we stood up. And that 2 million people represented so many more, didn't it? How many people there were waving them off on the coaches? How many people were demonstrating in other cities in our country on that magical day, yeah? And then people came to me and says, they're going to do it. Oh, what can you do? They didn't listen. Why didn't we come back with 5 million, 10 million? Why didn't we? Why didn't we? 30,000? Wow, I'm underwhelmed. Are we really going to give a shit? Oh, these people are going to be dead by the time we actually do something about it. Because the bottom line is, of course, Bush and Blair committed the same crime that the Nazis were hung for at Nuremberg. Do you know the number one crime? To initiate a war of aggression is the number one crime. From that crime, all the other war crimes come. Yeah? It's common sense, isn't it, when you think about it? 45 minutes, Mr. Blair. 45 minutes, Mr. Blyer. Dodgy dossiers. Plagiarized thesis. 45 minutes, sexy lie. And for that, all the innocents have to die. That's how it started, isn't it? 5 years ago now. 5 years ago. 5 years. Do you know what? I'm sure the people of Iraq and Afghanistan are so grateful to us. After murdering at least 2 million of their people, we're here saying, oh, it's naughty, stop. And then we're going away again, aren't we?
Are you going away or not?
I wish I could. With all my heart, I wish I could go away. 7 years, 24/7 on this pavement. What's happening over there? Well, everybody's being murdered. Check out the arms industry, the number one money-making business in the world. It's all about money. Check out the drugs industry, the second biggest money-making racket in the world. Check out the drugs coming from Afghanistan. That's what it's all about. The Taliban regime, this wicked, awful regime, cut the drugs back to 150 tons, the poppy production, yeah? It's gone up to 5,000-6,000 tons and growing now. We've liberated them. Second biggest money-making racket. Oh, some people are making a fortune out of this. And on our streets, the people are being controlled with the drugs. We did that to the Chinese people all those years ago with opium, didn't we? Turned them into zombies. And our people are f***ing zombies. I'm sorry. Drinking? Drugs? When are we going to wake up and care? When are we going to be human? I'm here because I'm personally responsible for what my country is doing to other people, am I not?
The FM 93.2.
Can I apologise, please? I'm sorry, very sorry for the swearing on that piece. And I think probably the best thing to do now is to have a little bit of music to take us up to the end of the show. That was Brian Hoare speaking, the peace activist that died last month. But again, apologies for the swearing on that piece, which I'm afraid I hadn't listened right thoroughly all the way through, which I think I should have done. Apologies again, and let's have some music to take us up to the end of the show.
Into each life some rain must fall, but too much is falling in mine. Into each heart some tears must fall, but someday the sun will shine. Some folks can lose the blues in their hearts, but when I think of you, another shower starts. Into each life some rain must fall, but too much is falling in mine.
Into each life some rain must fall, but too much is falling in mine.
In every life, some rain has got to fall, but too much of that stuff has fallen into mine. And into each heart, some tears has got to fall, but I know that someday that sun is bound to shine.
Some folks can lose heart,
but when I think of you, another shower starts. Into each life some rain must fall, but too much is falling in mine.
Ella Fitzgerald and the Ink Spots there. And just a public hearing is taking place on Wednesday, 20th of July. That's St. Stephen's Church, St. Stephen's Avenue, off Corn Street, BS1. A suggested donation of £5 is requested, not required. Bristol's race for wealth was built on the slave trade. Nothing controversial about that statement anymore. But does wealth creation in Bristol always have to make winners and losers? And what's happening is that we've got a couple of people from Bristol's community, Eastern's famous Bristol sweetmart proprietor Abdul Ghani will be speaking, and they will talk about his family's refugee to success story and the benefits of wealth creation. He'll be also joined by Marion Connolly, who left nursing and community work and the security of a council flat in favour of volunteering. That will take place at Wednesday, 20th of July at 7:30 p.m. at St. Stephen's Church. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Jenny Smith, Labour Councillor and Regional Vice Chair of PCS, Roger Thomas. Thanks also to Mary Milton from Shout Out, which is on at 7 p.m. on Thursdays, and to Dia Moodley from the Spirit of Life Church, just off the M32 in St. Paul's. We're at thisweek.org.uk. See you next week.